Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The death toll reaching to 100 people this week, Kabul has seen one of the bloodiest attacks since fall of the Taliban regime in 2001. Afghan authorities blame the Pakistan-based Afghan terrorist group Haqqani Network in orchestrating the attack and ordered the execution of a number of Taliban prisoners as a retaliation. In response, Taliban promised retaliation of their own against Kabul. This all happening in the shadow of the ongoing discussion in Washington, D.C. of the new Afghanistan strategy by Trump administration, though details of which remains mostly murky except the possible deployment of few thousand additional troops to Afghanistan. So what do we know about the U.S. administration's new Afghanistan strategy other than the rumored deployment of soldiers? Why is there so much lack of clarity, and what has the implication of this uncertainty been on the ground? This is our topic for this week. To discuss the subject, I have a panel of distinguished guests from Washington, D.C. I am joined by Dr. Samir Lalwani, the Deputy Director of Smithson Center's South Asia Program. From Indiana, USA, Douglas Wissing, author of the recently released book, Hopeless but Optimistic, Journeying Through America's Endless War in Afghanistan. From Prague, Abubakar Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, is with us. This site looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Gentlemen, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. With this, let's start with you, Douglas. I will come back to your very striking thoughts expressed in one of your recent op-eds that I saw on the Hill, which I should say made me very pessimistic about the contribution of many aspects of U.S.'s engagement in finding realistic solution to the Afghan problem. But before to get into that, what is the engagement looks like in the much-discussed Trump's new Afghanistan strategy other than the rumored potential deployment of 5,000 additional troops to the battlefield?
Well, I think your choice of words, murky, describes anything that I am hearing from Washington. It seems as though there's great policy disputes going on behind the curtains. And of course, President Trump ran on a platform of getting out of Afghanistan. He ran on an America First platform, and Steve Bannon is holding his feet to the fire on that one. On the other hand, he has appointed quite a number of generals into positions, national security positions, so they are pushing for a re-escalation. And as best I know, that's where we stand.
Samir, in terms of details, any insight on what is coming up in the Afghan strategy book of the President Trump?
I don't really have any special insights on this. I think I've been reading the same news accounts that we all have, which is this 3,000 to 5,000 troop estimate, mostly for a train, advise, assist mission. There was one article by Eli Lake that came out maybe a couple weeks ago suggesting an internal assessment was saying they would try to deploy up to that there was recommendations for up to 50,000 U.S. troops, but that was mainly sort of in terms of the logistical side. I don't think that's really going to ever surface in a real proposal. I don't think it's going to actually happen. But that might have been sort of an estimation of what's actually needed for some of the efforts. And most likely we'll just see this smaller figure, but then the open question is, for what purpose? Uh-huh. Right? That's the million-dollar question, is what is the strategy behind sort of a troop deployment? Because troops alone do not make a strategy. And I think that's something that is very murky here in D.C., in part because I think there's a lot of confusion about what priorities are.
You know, 3,000, 5,000, even I saw some figures, 13,000 or 15,000. So whose idea is this in first place?
I think the DOD and General Nicholson, commanders on the ground, have been saying that there's a shortage of troops necessary for the train, advise, assist mission. Right now, all the advisors are at the core level. And they don't have the personnel and sort of the freedom to sort of operate down at the brigade and battalion level, which means then sort of deploying with these units like in the field. And so then you'd be more exposed. So it sort of changes the rules of engagement and then also your force protection requirements. But I think that that's the push that's coming from DOD, is that they had some influence in improving certain battalions and certain brigades for a period of time, and they've lost the ability to both track that information, so we have an information problem. Huh. Then we also have sort of an influence problem in terms of sort of, you know, encouraging best practices and morale and things like that, because we're not as embedded in the lower units.
Douglas, what the other NATO member countries are saying on this, who have already withdrew their troops from Afghanistan, and many of them are no more in really good terms with President Trump?
Well, there was a press conference at the end of the NATO meeting back the 25th of May, where NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg seemed to speak as though the NATO alliance was going to continue their support in Afghanistan. But as we know, that support has always had a lot of strictures on it. And we, of course, also don't know how much that massive bomb in the embassy area of Kabul is going to impact NATO decisions, particularly Germany. So certainly there was something said from a podium at a press conference on the 25th of May that seemed to indicate NATO was going to carry on. But exactly what that carrying on will be is yet to be determined.
So, Abu Bakr, how is this discussion on troop level is reflected in Afghanistan and in regional capitals?
Well, I think as far as the Afghan government is considered, I mean, they will welcome any increase in troops and also any long-term commitment or short-term commitment to more Western aid. I think the Afghan government is really ready for that, but I think the region is not. The region or most of Afghanistan neighbors, particularly Pakistan, Iran, and also by now Russia, and maybe even China, they will not like to see an increase in Western, particularly U.S. troop numbers, because they all really very strong doubts. Some of these doubts they publicly express at times. For example, the Russian ambassador or special envoy for Afghanistan in an interview in December questioned the logic of U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan and kind of painted it as a threat to Russian security interests.
Afghanistan is ready for such an idea, increase in troop level, but not the region. If this goes ahead, despite the displeasure or disagreement by the region, what is the consequences?
Well, the consequences is that we clearly have, I think now, there are a few things happening. We always had Pakistan kind of on the wrong side of where things, the West and particularly the Afghan governments after 2001 wanted to move. For example, after this Kabul bombing, the Afghan intelligence was very quick in blaming Pakistan. They even named Pakistan's intelligence service and accused it of supporting and sheltering Haqqani network, which they claim is responsible for this attack. So, but now we have, in 2001, ironically, Iran supported the U.S. intervention. And now I think Iran is not only opposed to it, but Iran has kind of sees Taliban as somehow one of the players that is that it sees is capable of protecting its interests in Afghanistan. And the same is true for Russia. China, I think, would not like, at least for now, it doesn't want any kind of Taliban or harsh Islamist regime coming back to power in Afghanistan. But at the same time, its ties with Pakistan are so close that Islamabad can maybe influence its outlook on Afghanistan. Mm. On that count, there are a lot of challenges, and I think what this administration is indicating, I mean, in terms of breaking kind of new ground in foreign policy, this kind of regional backing for its intervention in Afghanistan will be one of its main challenges.
You know, we are talking based on this only information that we have from the expected strategy, the Afghan strategy of these troop level increase. So talking about this, Samir, you heard Abu Bakr saying that about the potential reaction by the region. So with the idea of troop increase, are we making things worse?
Again, I think it depends on the strategy. If you say that you're going to increase troop levels, but your objective is a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, and so the idea is that there is a very clear opportunity for the Taliban to have a role in some sort of Afghan future, whether in government or sort of power sharing or asymmetric federalist sort of structure, then I think you might actually get some potential hedging or cooperation from the regional actors. I think Russia, Iran, and Pakistan, and because of Pakistan's interest, China, seem to have a theory of stability in Afghanistan that requires the Taliban to have some role in sort of an Afghan future, probably in government. And because of that theory, if we start out from a strategy saying our objective is to defeat the Taliban and to exclude them from the prospects of having a role in a future government, then we're inherently going to trigger the counter reactions of all those four regional powers. They will work against our interests. If we can indicate that there's a mutual shared interest here, then maybe we'll get some collaboration. I mean, there's tactical reasons why Iran and Russia are sort of playing against us, and even Pakistan to some degree, is because they're worried about generally about sort of U.S. power in the region, long-term basing, what those bases can be used for besides fighting the Taliban. They have intelligence and kinetic capabilities that can do other things in the region. And it's even been talked about in the United States as well, as what we'd use those bases for in the future contingencies. So they'll be wary of that. But maybe if you can convince those actors that there is a mutual sort of interest here about some sort of negotiated settlement, which I think is ultimately their objective, then you might be able to get them to cooperate on it. But I think we've been very unclear about this. We're not clear with ourselves. There's an interview that General McMaster did in Afghanistan back in April during his trip. And on the one hand, he's saying reconciliation is something that we should pursue. And on the other hand, he's saying the Taliban must be defeated. And unless we have sort of very loose definitions of what those two things mean, those, in theory, are actually mutually exclusive.
Okay. Thank you, Samir. If the troop deployment is the only option or the highlight of the new strategy, then the question is, how much is this move aligned with needs of the reality on the ground? And also, if not troops, then what really U.S. can possibly do to deter the situation, which some say has reached to the unsustainable point? Let's talk about these aspects shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective, and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, just to recap the debate that today on Gandhara, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Pakistan and Afghanistan podcast, we are discussing the new Afghanistan strategy of the Trump administration, or lack of which. Joining me in the discussion are Dr. Samir Lalwani, the Deputy Director of Simonson Center South Asia Program, Douglas Wissing, author of recently released book called Hopeless but Optimistic, Journeying Through America's Endless War in Afghanistan, and Abubakar Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Gentlemen, welcome back to the Gandhara podcast. Coming back to the rumored idea on 5,000 additional reinforcement to Afghanistan, anything being said about the concrete objective? We touched upon this, but let's focus a little bit on this aspect. Douglas, starting with you.
Yeah, the concrete objective, that is still the big problem that I keep encountering as I speak with people about this. No one seems to know what our real objectives are. We, as was said, it's very unclear even with ourselves. We state that we're going to try to defeat the Taliban to drive them to the negotiating table, which hasn't worked for this long. We're speaking about adding 5,000 more troops, expecting that to somehow change the situation on the ground when 100,000 didn't. We're expecting the Taliban to negotiate when they hold somewhere around 40 to 50% of the countryside and are pressuring the government centers as we speak. They didn't negotiate when there were 100,000 U.S. troops in the country, and they held about 7% of the territory. So it's conjectural as to why we would think they would do that now. As someone told me quite a number of years ago, the Taliban don't see the need to negotiate. They're winning. And the Taliban has been growing at double digits since about 2005 each year. The dictum by the special forces has long been of an insurgency is shrinking, it's winning. And that's certainly what we're seeing in this case. So mm-hmm. it may be wishing and hoping for that, not quite strategy to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then if not troops, then what? Looking from Afghanistan, given unprecedented spike in Taliban's attack, it's obvious that something has to change, something must be done. Is the increase in troop level is what they are in need of, Abu Bakr?
Well, I think one of the key things is, I mean, we all agree on the point, and maybe we have different ways of putting it, is that the main confusion is not in Afghanistan. The main confusion is in Washington. And I think in my own view, it is because of how different people, personalities or institutions perceive what is American interest in Afghanistan and how to pursue those interests. So from an Afghan perspective, I think one of the main things that Afghans would like to have is guarantees of long-term commitments. And it's political commitment, but also material commitment, economic aid, plus military aid, and also, I think, a greater understanding of what actually can help Afghanistan. For example, I think one of the things that Afghans are very keen in this part of their four-year security strategy is that they want to double the numbers of Afghan special forces, which are now, I think, they number 17,000 and have proved to be one of the most effective forces against insurgents. So, for example, if in 2 years Afghanistan can have 50,000 special forces or 35,000 special forces, that will increase its ability to hold on to major population center and reclaim some of the rural areas. One of the key things that Afghanistan has always sought and still seeks from Washington and Western capitals is to help in solving its problem with regional countries. And I think Afghanistan's main problem is with Pakistan. The two countries have so far failed to agree on any kind of lasting cooperation, particularly counterterrorism cooperation. Both countries have great self-interest in promoting that kind of cooperation now. And I think in Afghanistan, I mean, President Karzai used to say it publicly, Ashraf Ghani is more perhaps diplomatic about it, but most Afghans think that only Washington has the leverage or that it can incentivize cooperation for Pakistan. And one other key thing that Afghanistan, which will help with stability in Afghanistan immediately, is an end to the Taliban or militant sanctuary in Pakistan. I mean, we recently have all these reports, and still in Pakistani mosques, there are funds being raised for militants. If not all, but most of Taliban leadership remain in Pakistan. And if I'm not a military man, but if you study counterinsurgency globally, insurgency that have secure rear bases and that kind of logistical support outside the borders of the countries they are fighting, it's very difficult to defeat or degrade them militarily.
Deterring Pakistan, Samir, is it something U.S. can deliver, or is it anyway in someone's mind in Washington, D.C., when talking about the new strategy?
I don't think the problem is deterring Pakistan. It's compelling Pakistan. It's a different problem that Schelling describes. Compellence is much harder than deterrence. So when we're talking about this debate in Washington, and we're saying that's the fundamental locus of confusion, I disagree with that. I think Washington is fundamentally confused about it, but I also think there's fundamental confusion and disarray within Kabul itself. And that's a problem that we've had a hard time facing up to, because there's never been any attention on forcing Kabul to get its act together. And that means Afghan politicians and leaders who continue to play patronage politics and continue to dole out positions for the purposes of either, you know, corruption, patronage, or personal gain. So when you hear these discussions in D.C. that are happening, they're really aspirational. Like, these are strategic discussions that basically say we need a lot of things. We need more professionalism of the Afghan army. We need to end corruption. We need regional cooperation. We need an end to sanctuaries. These are great aspirations. There's no strategy as to how you achieve those ends. And so since we're on the discussion of sanctuaries, I think Abu Bakr is absolutely right. The literature on counterinsurgency says that when an insurgent organization has a safe haven, it's much more likely to prevail or for the state to lose. There's also a lot of literature that suggests that even in the absence of a safe haven, there's insurgencies are very successful. If you look at the trend lines, state counterinsurgency victory over the last multiple decades, the trend lines are very poor for state success. What happens is you either end up in a loss or a draw. And a draw essentially means some sort of negotiated end to the conflict or sort of a continual residual conflict. And that's something that we need to pay close attention to. The last thing I also say is, because we're going to this question of deterrence versus compellence, the problem in Pakistan with Pakistan is that we've tried in many ways to convince them through cajoling, persuasion, pressure. And we're constrained in part because it's a nuclear power. So compelling a nuclear power to do things is extremely difficult. It's actually very rare, if impossible. Look at our situation currently with North Korea. They have nuclear weapons, and pretty much the entire world is against sort of what North Korea is doing. And yet we don't really have any kinetic options to compel them to do things other than sort of a few carrots and sticks. So it's a difficult proposition. And the second is that we have other equities in the region that matter either as much or more than Afghan stability. And if you look at the discussions of U.S. strategy over the last 15 years, the three reasons why we're in Afghanistan have always been about homeland security, nuclear security, and then finally, Afghan stability is sort of the third concern. Mm-hmm. But homeland security and nuclear security, I would argue, rest much more on Pakistan than on Afghanistan. And that's why you have this confusion in priorities. It's hard to compel Pakistan on the one hand while also relying on them for homeland security and nuclear security issues. And also, you know, by the way, your logistics tail through the ground lines of communication, airlines of communication that heavily depend on Pakistan. So we had that tension that we really can't resolve.
Okay. You know, this confusion in D.C., confusion in Afghanistan, and Afghan authorities' inability to act united in many fronts. But things are getting worse, as we have seen in the example of Kabul attack and the Taliban's ability to capture more and more territory, as you said, Douglas. So how long can the Afghan administration sustain under current circumstances, Douglas?
It is clearly dependent on U.S. aid and U.S. support, the current Afghan regime. And as was said earlier, that I agree with completely, the debate in Washington and the impasse that we're finding in Washington does relate in part to the endemic corruption in the Afghan government. It's been ranked as one of the world's most corrupt for many years. It's ninth on the Fragile State Index that indicates vulnerability to conflict and collapse. It is down at the very bottom of the rule of law index that the World Justice Project does. It's 111th out of 113th. The Afghan security forces have been widely reported to be extremely corrupt and somewhat ineffective, with the exception of the special forces, or the special operations teams, which seems to be the primary functioning units in the Afghan security forces. And so all of those things add into the American taxpayers are on the hook for somewhere around $1 trillion for the Afghanistan war. The much maligned counterinsurgency strategy said you had to have the North Star of that was that you had a strong host government, and we don't have that. The current regime is ranked to be generally ineffective. So, and then we lay on top of that the extraordinary failure of U.S. development and aid in Afghanistan, where we have spent somewhere over $117 billion, which is more money than was spent on the Marshall Plan, adjusted for inflation. This is on a country of about 30 million people. And when we invaded, before we started that, Afghanistan was at the bottom of every human development indices. We're now 16 years later, we've spent $117 billion, and Afghanistan remains at the bottom of virtually every human development indices. The Afghans are the victims of phantom aid, greed in both the host country and the donor country. As we're talking about this, they're arguing this in Washington. We don't have a good situation. We haven't even talked about the logistical problems of supplying troops. You know, they're in a pretty bad neighborhood, as you folks have talked about. So do we continue this or do we stop?
That's the vital question. Let's expand that. Earlier in our private conversation, Samir, you asked me a similar question, as much as I didn't like even the idea of putting it on the table. But it is your reality. If you are a policymaker in D.C., that you must think first about your own immediate constituent, especially in this era of America First policy. When you have things to do in your own towns, why to spend billions of dollars in Afghanistan? Right. So let me pose this question to Abu Bakr. Why U.S. should care at all about what happens in Afghanistan? And Samir, did I put the question rightly?
I think that's right. I would say just caveat by saying why should we continue with this sort of long-term indefinite nation-building project relative to other options that might be on the table, like a containment strategy?
Abu Bakr?
Well, I think I mean, I will argue that the U.S. is not, with due respect to my colleagues in the United States, the United States is not in Afghanistan for charity. It is there for self-interest. I mean, basically national security interests that prompted the intervention after 9/11. There were a lot more Afghan civilians dying and being oppressed by warlords and factions in the 1990s. But the international community, mostly Western countries, they all closed their embassies and simply left. And I mean, President Karzai and other Afghan leaders are still complaining about it. So I think the best way to look at it is, yes, of course, sometimes the debate in Washington is very simplistic and superficial. But I think in the larger scheme of things, the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan is in pursuit of its vital national interests. Now, it's for the American policymakers to argue against this or for it. But I think at this point, we are so far down this road that a precipitous withdrawal, even artificial deadlines, as we saw with the Obama strategy, they are likely to backfire. So engagement is number one. And I think we should not undermine the prospects and the tremendous result that political diplomacy and political settlement can deliver. For example, I'll give you one example. If for some magical reasons, Pakistan and Afghanistan agree on state-to-state relations where they'll have no role for any kind of a non-governmental, non-state actors, which will require Pakistan to stop hosting or supporting Afghan Taliban, or at least turning a blind eye to their presence in the southern province of Balochistan or tribal areas or wherever else. And Afghanistan can reciprocate by doing the same for Pakistani Taliban, which Islamabad frequently alleges are present in eastern Afghan provinces. So that will, I think, resolve some of the big security challenges that we see, which is kind of now emerged as a major threat to the Afghan state. And then, of course, we had all these other processes. And we should not forget, if one thing, not undermine the potential that Afghans themselves have. For example, this whole deal with Hikmatyar, the Afghans negotiated it among themselves. They pulled it off. Hikmatyar is now living peacefully in Kabul. So with the right kind of support and the right kind of understanding, I think we can see some visible improvement in the situation, although for Afghanistan to really stabilize, it will take a long time.
Samir, counter argument?
you were just assuming I was going to have the counter argument, huh?
Yeah,
I think he's right. Mm-hmm. We went to Afghanistan for national security purposes, and we're mm-hmm. still there on the basis of national security purposes, not for charity. He's absolutely right. But there are different ways to achieve national security, right? That's what strategy is all about. Some strategies are costly and expensive and don't work. Some strategies are maybe more efficient and smarter. And so I think that's what the United States needs to weigh, is can it achieve its objectives in Afghanistan, which was principally about a homeland security concern. Oh. And then a secondary concern was a nuclear security concern. Can it achieve those objectives oh. in a different way, maybe for a lower cost, maybe more efficiently, with less blood spilled, with fewer conflicts with multiple great powers in the region? If it can, it's incumbent on them to consider that, regardless of how the chips might fall in Afghanistan. That's what a U.S. strategist needs to think about first. Is what are sort of our, you know, obligations for the U.S. public. Obviously, there's concerns about what happens in Afghanistan after, and there's ways to manage and mitigate that, but it may not require an indefinite U.S. kinetic presence in Afghanistan that costs $50 billion plus dollars a year when we have a lot of other engagements in the world that are of equal concern. And I'll just add one last thing, which is that there's a lot of criticism about the Obama administration's artificial deadlines backfiring. It's standard practice now to critique the foolhardiness of the Obama administration doing this. I think people need to go back and look at what the logic of that those deadlines were. There were two, and they're pretty important. One is the domestic politics logic, which is that you can't get Congress to authorize an indefinite commitment to Afghanistan, especially when they were also being asked to scale up troops, mm-hmm. right? So the Obama administration was scaling up troops from what was about sort of 40,000 to ultimately 100,000 U.S. troops. And if you tell Congress, we're going to just keep 100,000 troops there indefinitely after a Democratic Party that was just in power had won elections on the basis of withdrawing or drawing down troops from Iraq, you're going to have a really tenuous situation. So there was no domestic politics that was going to support anything beyond sort of a very clear, defined engagement and withdrawal plan. Second logic behind this, though, is actually another important one, which is some sort of conditionality on the host nation. What we've learned from a lot of research over the last 15 years and even prior to that is that security force assistance, which is ultimately what this U.S. mission is to Afghanistan now, does not work if the host nation is not willing to collaborate. And the reason host nations tend to sort of not collaborate is because they think that they have a blank check. And the only way to get them to believe that there's some sense of urgency is to have some sort of conditionality and even ultimatums. And this is what worked in cases when security force assistance has been effective at improving the quality of security and military effectiveness. So the case of South Korea in the 1950s, we had the same problems in terms of getting South Koreans to actually professionalize their army and fight effectively rather than using it as patronage or personal networks. Hmm. And the only way that it was compelled them to change their behavior was, number one, an existential threat of collapse as the North Korean military was invading. And number two, an ultimatum from the United States saying we are done with withdrawing if you do not make these changes. We've never been able to do that with Afghanistan. And so having some sort of boundary as to sort of when you're going to leave or when you're going to sort of walk away is necessary for bargaining with the host nation.
Hmm. This is what I had in mind when I asked the counter argument. Okay, we are getting into the final stage of our discussion, unfortunately. The last point, Douglas, so tell me, please, you are hopeless but still optimistic, just to borrow my question from the title of your book. So what makes you hopeless and why you are still optimistic?
Well, that quote came from an Afghan government official. I had traveled through the war zone and had interviewed a lot of different people and got to Kabul and was somewhat hopeless about the U.S. war-making, our corporatized, the way we have been doing things, being a total failure, our development being a total failure. And I decided I would try to find something to make me optimistic. So I went around Kabul, and I was trying to find NGOs that had been doing sustainable things for a long time, going back even into the King's period. And were they doing things in an Afghan appropriate way, and how were they doing it? And I did begin to have some dawning optimism about there are ways that this can be done other than the dysfunctional ways that we had done them over the last 16 years. And I was also interviewing a broad stripe of Afghan government officials. And one day I was interviewing this man in his office building, and I had a stock question where I would say, well, the Americans are clearly withdrawing, and how are you feeling about that? And he threw himself up and he said, I am hopeless but optimistic. Mm. And I thought it was just a great way to think about this. And I asked another government official the same question, and he said, oh, I'm optimistic. I'm an Afghan. What else can I do? Wow. So that is where the title came from. And I have to say I have an enormous fondness for Afghans. I have an enormous respect for the Afghans. And the way that they are in the world and their courage and their sense of poetry and beauty is something that I think is quite remarkable, their sense of allegiance to their countrymen and their families. I have great respect for them. So my sense of optimism really comes from Afghans being allowed to do things the Afghan way. I don't think Afghanistan is going to become Switzerland or Sweden. I think it's Afghanistan, and it needs to be able to evolve in a way that relates to something that is sustainable. Obviously, the U.S.-imposed constitution that centralized everything has created vast problems. There are things will have to happen. I can't predict that. My job is to observe and report, and I can say that more of the same won't yield a different outcome. That's why I'm hopeless but optimistic. I think the answer comes with a new strategy, comes with stopping doing what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for fascinating and intriguing thoughts. Douglas Wissing, author of recently released book called Hopeless but Optimistic, and also Dr. Samir Lalwani, the Deputy Director of Simitson Center's South Asia Program, and Abu Bakr Siddiq, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today on the Gandhara podcast.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Until next podcast, bye-bye.